today, my man. How you doing? Welcome back to the show.
Hey, brother. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's been a bit of time, right? I mean, you've been on twice. I was looking back at when the last time was. It was quite a while back. What have you been up to? What have you been up to? And maybe I'm taking a leap, but it feels like you took a step back from this space, pivoted, and have come back maybe with a different energy. So maybe speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's no surprise that I was going through a lot in my social media journey. And I did pivot to different things, but I really just came back to what I love, which I love ultimately is helping people. So I like to help them through evidence-based nutrition and fitness. And I like to do that through my own unique way. I'm just really, really happy to be back and trying to do what I love and also trying to help myself because I went through a lot through these recent years, even with my own health journey and stuff like that.
How is that going? How has that affected just how you felt about the space? The space being the like health, you know, the eye roll, health, fitness, wellness, you know, from evidence-based to bullshit, the whole space. How has your own journey affected kind of your ability or want to help others? Well, it's always wanting to help others, maybe how you've chosen to do that.
Yeah. So what I really struggled with a lot was with my mental health journey for many years. I was struggling with my mental health for many years. I'm going to be candid. So I have, you know, major depressive disorder and a generalized anxiety. And it was really affecting my health because I wasn't engaging in physical activity as I should have. I wasn't necessarily eating the right foods like I should have. I wasn't really taking care of myself. I was avoiding a lot of the issues and challenges of my life for a good time period. And my physical health declined as a result. You know, I became morbidly obese because of that. I struggle with sleep apnea, I struggle with diabetes because of, you know, my mental health challenges affecting my physical body. And it kind of changed my whole perspective on a lot of different things because I realized that, you know, the mind and the body really are connected. And if your mental health is, excuse my language, fucked, your physical body is going to be, you know, screwed in the process. So I kind of took a step back, started working with people who also struggle with mental illness. And it really kind of changed the trajectory of my life. I'm just a lot more patient. I'm a lot more kind with myself and others. And I'm less judgmental as I used to be, less strict as I used to be with, you know, how people do things.
It's always interesting because you want to be like, I want to make sure we're using like appropriate terminology and all of that. If you want to rephrase the way I say something, you should. So I will say something and I'd love for you to spit it back to me in a way that you're like, yeah, that I agree mostly a little bit, not at all. When you said, okay, I've been struggling with depressive symptoms and we'll put like a slash depression, clinical depression, you know, in a similar, let's say bucket or sentence, there's a lot of rhetoric that I've seen you speak to about this, like, hey, this like exercise is unbelievable for depression. Exercise is amazing for mental health. It's more powerful than antidepressants. I've always felt that that's super cool in so far as, yeah, we see that there's a link here and moving your body probably has mental health benefits. There's so much of a link there, but there's a little bit of a non-starter where like somebody who actually has depression is probably also the kind of person who's really struggling to metaphorically, physically get up and do something good for themselves. So it's kind of this weird catch 22 is not the right word, but you hear this a lot. The headline is exercise is more powerful than antidepressants fighting against depression. And I've always felt a little bit tricky where it's like, the people in my life that have suffered from depression, it's actually like almost clinically categorized as a kind of person who's really struggling to take positive action for themselves. So how do we marry the fact that there's some truth to like, hey, moving your body as a catch-all for like exercise is, you know, probably good for mental health. And if as a person who has depression, if you can get them to do something that's probably in the helpful bucket, how do we marry the idea that that's probably true, but also, hey, we need to like cool it with that to some degree with expectations because the whole like, symptom or expression of depression is that this is a person who's like really struggling to do something positive for themselves.
Yes. So I agree with 98% of what you said. It's very true that I see depression more as a spectrum, right? Like there's mild and moderate forms, and there's very severe forms of depression. So when you're talking to someone who has mild or moderate forms, it's easier for them to engage in physical activity. And a lot of the studies related to exercise and depression are usually in those with mild and moderate forms of depression. The problem is when you get to this very severe forms of depression, it's stuff that, you know, I unfortunately deal with. And for those individuals, their symptoms are very, very profound. It's very difficult to treat in many different cases. And you would be lucky to have many of these individuals just getting up and out of bed and active in any sort of way. So it really depends on who we're talking about and how severe their depression is. Just realizing that exercise is a tool, but it's a tool out of many to help individuals with depression. I think exercise can be therapeutic, but there's also other interventions that we have, you know, such as CBT, such as medication. It's not an either or thing. I think that people make it into either or thing because a lot of people like to appeal to nature, like appeal to what's natural, and they don't like medication. I'm not saying the medication is perfect, but in many different cases, I've seen it firsthand. And the research agrees with me. It helps many different people what they're going through.
Yeah, I'm going to make an analogy here that is maybe imperfect. And again, it kind of segues a little bit into what I want to talk about today about obesity being a choice and biopsychosocial model. And maybe my analogy is not perfect here, but I've seen secondhand multiple times in my life in a very palpable way that people close to me where... there's like this big anti-medication, like naturalist fallacy, just like people assuming that that's all negative and man-made, we should do it naturally, all this stuff. And what I've seen is that medication, antidepressants, let's be specific, have helped some people in my life as a way of allowing them to get to a place where they feel more comfortable pursuing some of those lifestyle things. It almost like, but the antidepressant put them in a place where they were better able to establish some of those positive lifestyle habits that ultimately long-term were really helpful. And whether or not that was like so that they could ultimately get off the medication or just, again, just to ultimately get to a better place. I see an analogy with the GLP, a lot of these GLP-1 weight loss medications where people are just like so have no fucking clue what they're talking about with these drugs, but like I've seen it with many clients over the last 5 years. These drugs allow people to, not instead of, but allow them to now, with a reduction in food noise, with a reduction in satiety, with a reduction in food focus, make these lifestyle changes. It's not instead of these lifestyle changes. It's not even just in conjunction with. It's like, so that I can. And so I've seen that with antidepressants as well, where like people become more inclined to maybe want to, it's given them a help, maybe a jump kickstart, I don't know the right terminology, but allowed them to go on and maybe engage and get into some exercise habit and maybe be more productive in their therapy and be more productive in some of those lifestyle things. And I think there's some analogy of that where it's not an either or, they are, you know, symbiotic, they're helpful to one another. And in this case, maybe helps people get to a point where they now can do all of these fun lifestyle things that people talk about as being super helpful. But I think people are forgetting that for a certain person, a certain circumstance with certain symptoms, maybe this is the thing that will help them ultimately do that. Is there an analogy there that tracks?
Yeah, that tracks perfectly. Because a lot of times it is a Kickstarter for people to get out of bed, follow the routine that they normally do, engage in some type of helpful behaviors. Because, you know, a lot of times, like me and my own medicational journey, like I was really good when I was consistently taking my medication, as far as like engaging with life, doing things that I had to do, even helped me get to the gym when I didn't feel like going to the gym. So a lot of times it is like a Kickstarter for many different people. It helps you cope with certain things that are going on. You do feel better. And for many different people, you do feel slightly better than what you did before. So with that increase of mood, oftentimes comes that increase of motivation to want to do things. And then when you do things, it just helps from there. One of the interventions for major depression, which, you know, a lot of people don't really know about, is called behavioral activation. It comes from the cognitive behavioral therapies. And essentially it's saying that doing even the smallest action helps with mood. It helps with your kind of like thoughts related to depression and stuff like that. And in order to get to that point where you're able to do things in order to help better help yourself, you need something often to be that catalyst to get you to do that thing in the first place. So, you know, this is why interventions like medications can be helpful.
Yeah, I love that. That's super well said. Let's see how we can tie this into our first question, which is obviously a massively loaded question. And the question is obesity a choice? And I think that that, again, is like frustratingly broad, simplified, not just Pandora's box, but more of like, that's not a yes or no question by like the absolute stretch of the imagination, not even close. So where do we even begin to assess this question? And does it begin with a simple answer with a complicated follow-up, or is it complicated right from the get-go?
It's complicated right from the get-go because it's like, what do you mean by choice?
Totally.
Like, do we mean by, you know, specific behaviors? Do we mean by, what do we mean by choice itself? Like, what is choice? I think that's a very philosophical question. And something like my stance on it is obvious online. If people follow me, they know that I don't think it's a choice. I think it's a disease. But when people you typically say choice, they typically frame it as a moral sort of a moral language, that people are not making the right choices. That means the right decisions in their day-to-day lives, and that equals them becoming obese. I don't see it as that myopic because I've read a lot of the literature on obesity and sort of the obesity pathogenesis, and we're going to get into that a little bit. But I typically ask people, like, what do they mean by choice? And typically when I say that, you know, people are like, oh, stuffing your face, you know, eating fast food, not exercising, staying in bed all day, eating Cheetos and playing video games.
Yeah, I want to actually, there's a reason I have you on the podcast is because you are a very philosophical thinker, and you will do what you just did, which was begin with the question itself, which is, what do you mean by choice? And I think there's most people just aren't. This is not like me and you on some high horse. Oh, we're such deep thinkers and no, but like, this is what you and I are doing for a living. So on average, we're going to think about this deeper than usually the question asker. And so that's not a shot at the average person. It's just like, hey, like if I ask somebody about astrophysics, like I'm probably oversimplifying things too. But when you say choice, like, oh, the one thing I would want to bring up, we can go down a philosophical rabbit hole about that word. But like, I think that there's some like element about, so people are thinking, okay, is it, like you said, staying in bed all day and playing video games, and it's about what you put in your mouth, and that is ultimately 100% up to you. I think people forget how little control you have over circumstances that make choices easier for you. And so, yeah, they are, if you were to like draw a flow chart, there's probably a last part of that flow chart that looks like a choice. But there were so many predeterminants to how likely you were to make that, how easy that choice was to make for you, how likely, you know, the likelihood that you'll end up making choices that fall in the healthier bucket on average. And so, yeah, you go to Applebee's and you order the salad with the grilled chicken or the Bloomin' Onion. That's at Outback, whatever. But like that sounds like a singular choice. And you're like, well, if you just keep doing the chicken with the salad, then this won't happen to you. And it's like, yeah, but there's so many things that go into, on average, your decision-making. It's like your decisions, I'm not saying are completely predetermined, right? We're not having this argument of like, you know, we have no autonomy. There's no agency. We have no power. We have no choice. But it's certainly not on the other end of the spectrum where like, yeah, you're just this completely autonomous being making decisions that you are based on your own values that you made up yourself, that were not brought down through genetics and lifestyle and environment and where you grew up and where you are now and finances. And it's like, yeah, you're saying, is obesity a choice? It's like, there are choices involved in this process somewhere. Totally. But the idea that you're the one just 100% in charge of all of this, and that the choices you make are, it's just not true. There's so much privilege within this that makes one more or less likely to develop obesity as a disease. So I'm glad you brought that up. I don't want to gloss over it. I think that the word choice is interesting.
Yeah. Just, you know, just to add to that, you know, we have research and literature showing that food advertisement, food marketing does impact people's buying behavior. We have evidence of interventions where if we cut down on, you know, the marketing of said food companies, that that does also impact, you know, choice and behavior. So if choice wasn't influenced by outside forces and outside factors, we wouldn't even have marketing to begin with. We wouldn't have certain, you know, things in our world to begin with. So I think like it's really important for people to realize that they don't make choices in a vacuum. Obviously, corporations, obviously outside groups, they know the power of influence and persuasion, and they know the power of other factors such as proximity, which is why we have literature on fast food outlets being predominantly like concentrated in poorer neighborhoods. I mean, I don't think those things are coincidences. It really is about the circumstances of the person, and that really does shape the choices that they make. Obviously, there's choices that can go contrary to the circumstances, the social context, but oftentimes it's like what shapes your choices, what shapes your behavior is an interconnected, I guess, play of many different things that just lead to that specific outcome. So it's not like it's just one person that has complete autonomy or complete free will making bad choices. It's also what's going on around them that's affecting those choices, that's really influencing those choices. And I see it all the time with the folks that I work with. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
When we talk about like people will, and I think people should hear this statistic, and we'll go back and forth breaking it down a little bit, but the heritability of obesity is estimated to be somewhere between, depending on who you ask, you know, between 40% and 70%. Can you just explain what that statistic means?
So heritability means specifically that a particular, let's say, trait will be passed down from, I guess, one generation to another, particularly through the parents, relatives, etc. And we see this all the time with psychiatric diseases in general or illnesses, that when your parents have X or Y disease, their children are more likely going to have it, and their children are more likely going to have it. So with obesity, if it's heritable, which we have evidence that it is, if individuals are classified as obese, their children are more likely going to be obese as well. We see like when we're having that whole discussion with depression is very similar. It's very heritable as well. So there's, you know, there's connections between, I guess, certain disease states and genetics. And we know that for a fact.
Yeah, we know that for a fact. We have twin studies that we lean quite heavily on in this regard. And could we speak to some of the, it doesn't need, I don't need us, we don't need freaking like specific genes, but some of the, how those genes might express themselves in differences between one another genetically that may predispose one to developing obesity. You know, an example being like, you know, on an average level of baseline hunger. It's like if I'm just on average have a higher baseline hunger, and that could be from a multitude of different things hormonally, but that's something that genetically, again, not a choice. I am hungrier than you, then on average, I would predict that that person eats more calories over the lifespan. And so we have something like, okay, I'm, you know, I one X person might be on average have a higher level of baseline hunger than Y. There's a bunch of other factors that might ultimately lead to somebody developing obesity. But you have two people that are just have different levels of baseline hunger. Are there others that jump to mind that are just like, people should just be like, oh yeah, that's totally a thing.
Yeah, so I mean, there's perfect examples of I love the one paper about the Endocrine Society. It's called Obesity Pathogenesis by the Endocrine Society, and they go over a lot of the genetic and neurobiological implications of obesity. And a lot of times, the biological circuits that regulate hunger, that regulate weight, do have, I guess, genetic variances. So certain individuals that have certain gene expressions can, for instance, be less satiated when they eat, or you know, they're more likely to be resistant to something like leptin, or you know, a hormone that helps regulate hunger, Or, for instance, they may, when they overeat, typically the body adjusts. It's like caloric regulation. It's homeostatic regulation. And for some people, it's not like that too much. So, you know, there's definitely like, I can't really name specific genes off the top of my head.
I wouldn't want you to, definitely. Yeah.
But yeah, there's genetic variances within the neurobiological circuitry that helps regulate weight. And like I said, the Endocrine Society, the Obesity Pathogenesis, that's a really great paper to look over that. That's something that people don't really think about, like genetics and also the fact that there are neurobiological implications of weight. So when you talk about things like the hypothalamus that helps control weight, a lot of times if that is dysregulated, as we often see with those with obesity, it's way easier for them to gain weight over time. It's harder for them probably to control their appetite or satiety. So, you know, these are definite factors outside of just choice that can impact someone's risk of obesity.
Yeah. If X person is hungrier on average than Y person, and X person gets less satiated from a meal than Y person, and X person gets greater food reward from food than Y person, I'm betting on that person eating more on average over time. There's a very similar reward response to exercise. Some people get really heightened response, feel amazing. You know, the old classic endorphin, mental health, positivity. Everyone, that you're going to hear the whole spectrum. People that are, oh, I go out for a walk, I go out for a run, I feel a million times better, all the way to like, I absolutely hate doing this and I don't get any of that sort of reward. And that makes you more likely to exercise on average because you get that chemical response more profoundly than another might. And so, yeah, choice is an interesting thing. Is that, am I praising somebody for exercising more if that person gets way more of a chemical reward from exercising than somebody else? It's like, well, I would bet on that. Yeah. I think we can get, not, I don't want to say caught up because this is the part of the conversation people are not talking about. I think that there's, again, it's just, I don't want to do the answer somewhere in the middle between choice or personal responsibility and genetics. It's just about understanding all of it together. It's not necessarily either or. I think there are people out there who need to acknowledge more that they do have power to make decisions. And there are other people on the other side of the spectrum that need to understand way more that a lot of this is not entirely predetermined. It has a large genetic and listen, we're gonna talk about biopsychosocial model and what that means in a second, but not just genetics. This is not just, genetics are huge, right? We just talked about a number of things that might express themselves in making somebody more likely to eat more calories over the lifespan, but this isn't just genetics. And so maybe we can pivot and talk a little bit about what the biopsychosocial model of obesity is.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect segue. So we focus a lot on the biological aspects of obesity, but there are also psychological and social implications of obesity. And the biopsychosocial model is really like the integration between biological, psychological, and sociological factors, which lead to a disease outcome. I was actually reading a paper, the original paper by George L. Engel, psychiatrist from the 1970s, who wrote the paper, The Need for a New Medical Model, A Challenge for Biomedicine. And this is where he introduced the biopsychosocial model. So essentially medicine, even to this day, there's some issues in medicine where it focuses too much on what Engels calls the biomedical model, which is, you know, we focus on a specific symptomology, a specific pathology of a disease, and we look for the biological, the biochemical abnormalities or implications of that. But as Engel said, the problem is applying that to psychiatry with something like schizophrenia, because at the time they didn't have really robust evidence for, let's say, brain imaging, let's say, you know, certain genetics related to schizophrenia. But he's like, you know, with these diseases, like, they're real, people are experiencing them, but because we're not looking for at a specific biological abnormality or pathology, the medical community is discounting it. And that is a problem because not every single disease state can be clearly defined under biological implications. So what that means is that we don't have a specific, you know, this gene causes this disease this, you know, abnormality in biochemistry causes this disease for many different diseases. And actually, like what he was pointing out is that there's many people who have diseases who feel fine. So it's like, why do these individuals feel fine? Or like there's individuals without a known disease state who feel awful. Why is that the case? That is a contradiction. So he proposed a more holistic view of looking at disease, which takes into account the psychosocial implications of disease, which at the time, a lot of physicians didn't even want to touch at all.
Can we give some examples of what that might look like of, hey, these are some things that are have nothing to do necessarily with genes that might predispose, not whatever, predispose, make somebody more likely to trend in towards in living in an obesogenic environment or, trending towards obesity as developing obesity later in life.
Yeah, so we mentioned it before, like those that have a lower socioeconomic status can live in neighborhoods which have a higher concentration of fast food outlets. So fast food is more accessible to them. So if you live now on the block from a McDonald's, for instance, you're more likely going to eat that McDonald's than going 10 blocks down to the grocery store. So, you know, access really does play a role in it. I talk about the food environment a lot. So where the availability of highly processed, ultra palatable foods is, you know, the more likely people are going to buy those foods and, you know, the higher concentration of calories those foods contain, they're more likely going to gain weight if that's what they're eating more than not. Also, you know, looking at situations such as, like I'm thinking about like many different things, but like the access, availability of food, also preparation, what people have at their disposal to cook and do certain things, people's jobs. Totally. So a lot of times that people that work long shifts or overnight shifts, they don't necessarily have the energy or ability to cook a highly nutritious meal. So they're more likely going to eat what's convenient to them. So these are just outside circumstances and factors which are not necessarily biological, but they're more social.
Yep. And that, and some of those things are passed down. And I think if I look back at my childhood, you know, there was, we were privileged in a privileged enough place to have a family dinner each night with that was cooked and prepared with a protein and whole foods. And that was something habits are passed down. It's not something that you can't, that there's no chance you can break and rewrite the future for yourself. It's not just, how I grew up is how my kids will grow up. It's not necessarily 100% like that, but I work with people every single day that are, you know, in their 40s, 50s, and 60s and can't cook scrambled eggs, right? Because that wasn't something that learning to cook something or, you know, making balanced meals wasn't something that was normalized, God forbid, even kind of encouraged. And that's not something that has anything necessarily to do with genetics. That's just, hey, I grew up in a family that did this and I developed these habits for many years that were normalized, reinforced, and now that's what I do. And I think that that's also something that, again, like I didn't earn, you know, nobody, you didn't do something to deserve that. That isn't necessarily a choice you made. Now, again, where do you find yourself on this? Yeah, what part of this choice versus genetics versus biopsychosocial model, like where do you find yourself saying, but we do still have decisions, we do still have, like, do you catch yourself going down that route and being like, well, I don't want to totally give up on this idea that there are things that we can do, that we still have power? Because that does seem like, yeah, I think giving up the idea that you have any power whatsoever, 0%, is yeah, defeatist, and probably just ends up not ultimately empowering people that they can do anything at all. So where do you find yourself communicating that balance of those two contrasting, you know, points of view?
So people typically say I have a defeatist mindset when it comes to obesity not being a choice. And I typically change the framing of obesity as a disease. That's supported by the American Medical Association, the CDC, the World Health Organization, many different other organizations, the designation of obesity as a disease. I prefer the designation of obesity as a disease to sit there and say there are multiple different complex causes of this outcome. People don't necessarily choose to be obese, but that doesn't mean that we don't have interventions for obesity, just as we wouldn't tell somebody with heart disease or type 2 diabetes that we don't have anything, they don't have anything that they could do for their situation. We don't sit there and say the same, we shouldn't say the same thing for those with obesity. That's kind of like more my perspective. Just like with diabetes or with heart disease, there are lifestyle-based interventions. There can be lifestyle-based interventions for obesity, but we know for a fact that many times those lifestyle interventions by themselves typically don't work for various different reasons. And they do work in many different cases for many different people, but they often don't. And it's like, what can we do from a medical perspective to help these lifestyle interventions work better? This is where the inclusion of GLP-1 drugs can definitely help make lifestyle interventions be more advantageous and effective, as well as other interventions as well.
This is slightly rhetorical, leading the witness here, but is it just having spent a lot of time yourself thinking about the complexity of something like obesity as a disease in a singular setting, but also, you know, as a planet becoming more and more overweight and unhealthy over time, does it absolutely pain you to see people reduce it down to like seed oils or, you know, carrageenan or some other single ingredient? I mean, is it just beyond painful? Have you gotten away from that sort of content? Like, have you just gotten so far away from that you're just, I don't know, not inundated with it on a daily basis?
So, you know, my thing is that people want singular causes for complex issues. That's just definitely how it is. It's how it is in our political arena. It's how it is in our social arena. And it's definitely how it is in the health space. People want singular causes for complex issues. It's so easy to look at, like, point a smoking gun at, say, seed oils, you know, for obesity, or say, oh, sugar for obesity. That was in the 2010s more. But the narrative is the same. It's the fear-mongering narrative. People want to gain money from simple causes to complex issues because they want to sell you on something. They want to sell you on their book. They want to sell you on their supplement. They want to sell you on their ideas. I think it's very frustrating as a creator, as a scientist and a science enthusiast to look at the complexity of a topic and really try to understand the nuances of a topic and then try to explain those nuances to people, just to have someone say, oh, that's bullshit. I saw on YouTube, you know, someone like Paul Saladino said seed oils are causing fucking obesity. And it's like, have you read any of the literature on obesity? Have you read any of the literature on what are we talking about here? Even you mentioned like just personal relationships. Like that's something that kind of escaped my mind, but that is so integral for people's health, like their personal relationships. Like, are you looking at any of the research or looking at the context of the person or taking any type of critical analysis to this issue? And a lot of times they're not.
Yeah. We don't need to go down seed oil route, but I always like, one of the studies I really love, like to throw the interesting part about arguing with like, what ultimately ends up being a science denier is that you don't have any power because your power is evidence and their power is not appreciating evidence as a meaningful argument. So it's like, you're like, this is the power I've brought and your power is that you've claimed all evidence is irrelevant. So like every time I like will have an argument, I have a seed oil post that cracks me. I did like a meme or whatever. It's up to like 1,000 comments. It must've gotten picked up by there's some crazy algorithm. I probably put some hashtags on there that made that more likely. And it has been, and I don't want to talk about it too much. I've talked about it on a previous podcast, but ultimately like you can't win the argument because the argument in our case, and again, it's not about winning the argument. It's about moving closer to the truth and aggregating our, you know, best evidence to come up with the best idea. It's just that that's not how they roll. So you can't actually convince somebody with evidence if they don't value evidence, which always cracks me up. But one of the studies in seed oils I really like is to throw it at these people is like, asking them, it's like, all right, they're like, oh, I stopped eating, you know, seed oils are making us fat or whatever. I stopped eating seed oils, I got healthier. And it's like, well, if you took a muffin and you cooked it with butter, or you took a muffin and you cooked it with seed oils, like, does it get healthier with butter? Is it better? And they're like, yes, of course, that would fix everything. That's what they think, that if you just took the seed oil as an individual item out of the foods and replaced it with animal fats, it would get better. They literally have a study that literally did that, where they have a muffin, same ingredients, cooked with saturated fat, and a muffin, same ingredients, cooked with seed oil, polyunsaturated fats, and whatever. Again, the study looked at like postprandial markers, which I don't think are like indicative of long-term changes, but they're at least showing that in the short term, this was a huge win. And so a huge win, by the way, for swapping out the saturated fat for the polyunsaturated fat, for the air quote, for the seed oil. And it's just, that one always cracks me up, because it's like, do you think it was because you ate less muffins and maybe less fast food and maybe whole foods? Or do you think it's because of the singular swap of seed oil to butter? They're like, no, it was definitely that. I'm like, it's definitely not that. I want it. Ask you a terrible, terrible question. Just a terrible question. Just not a good question. And it is, what is the solution to, or what are the solutions, things we can do, things as a society we can do to, combat the further degradation of health in our world? What matters? And I in my notes to you, I wrote, more macro coaches. And then I put like a little grin, because like, that's not, I coach people on an individual level, and on an individual level, I think I do a great job, but I don't think I don't think the answer is more of me in this world and we fix obesity as an epidemic. I don't think that's the answer. I think that's cool. I feel good. I can help a singular person and maybe more with good content, maybe, but it hasn't worked yet. Let's just say, it's not like, the wellness space grows every day and we get less healthy and less healthy. So when you think about, because I know you think about this on a way broader mindset, you are thinking about this on a larger scale. What the fuck do we do?
I mean, that's a big, big question. And I love that question, because I'm going to be honest with you. I played a lot with things in my mind, things about regulating industry, because I think industry is a large driver of our current obesity epidemic. If you look at things such as the nutritional transition, which is a concept created by a nutritional scientist, I forgot his name, but it talks about how corporations, specifically food corporations, really do drive public health in many cases in food environment and what's available to people. And then you notice that the more Western and industrialized the country becomes, their rates of obesity increases. So I think like regulation on industry is very important. We know that certain regulatory processes work better than others. Things like a soda tax, things like sugar reformulations, problems with food marketing. So ending food marketing to children, for instance, to combat childhood obesity. I think those can be very effective.
Can I pause you for 1 sec? So when we talk about government intervention regulations, do you feel any, not how I feel, not coming from necessarily where I'm coming from, but do you feel a slippery slope there at all? Because I tend to agree with everything you just said. I'm like, hey, like if we can modify the marketing towards children, if we can have some sort of regulation interventions I don't want to go all like tinfoil hat, big food, big Kellogg, but like they certainly control a lot of the food industry. And that's probably a net negative for our health on average, insofar as it is marketed to us. And, people are in power. A lot of funding goes to these food companies. But I get a little bit squirrely about it being a slippery slope of intervention into a free market. And we don't need to go mega political here, but do you I love everything you just said. I think it would do great. I think it would help a lot. Does it open Pandora's box in this way?
I don't see how it could, because we have regulation, for instance, for pharmaceutical companies. We have a regulation for agricultural businesses. We have regulation for environment. And those are for the greater good. I think that regulation for the greater good, the greater health of the country, outweighs sort of the short-term free market gains that a corporation may acquire. And that is probably a controversial statement for my free market lovers out there, but I think that the health and wealth of people in this country is more important than a couple of shareholders just making a couple more $1 million. I think it's really important to outweigh the costs and the benefits of a certain intervention. Obviously, it's not as clear cut as I'm saying it. It's not as clear cut as you're saying it, but I think it's very important. Because it's something that we know from the wider literature, from public health nutrition works, and we know that corporations have a difficult time regulating themselves. They'll say they regulate themselves, but are they really going to regulate themselves? Like, I think that's something that most people should kind of look past a little bit.
Something that comes up for me, a feeling I get when we have this conversation about regulations is this. So let's say I talk about being able to incorporate. I have a post coming out about a guy on Instagram I really love. I think you would love him too. His name's AJ. He's got just like a, I don't know if you follow him, he basically was saying something about how, you know, he didn't, a lot of extreme dieting over the years, a lot of this like good bad food dichotomy, morality around food and eating, really pushed him into a negative mental space and caused him to binge eat and ruin, you know, negatively impact frustration with food, ultimately eat, you know, a lot of food and, you know, gain a lot of weight. And for him, a balanced diet, realizing that he could have a Rice Krispie treat in the context of overall healthy diet, just whatever, this idea of like balance versus this clean eating kind of crazy people that are coming out eating everything off a cutting board, that sort of like clean eating, you know, avoid poison and toxins. My point is, do we, again, slightly annoyingly open-ended, terribly impossible question to answer, but I do feel when you start to bring in some interventions, do they come at the cost of, you know, like creating this dichotomy around food being good or bad? There are other countries that are doing this a little bit where they'll put like warning labels on something, right? And it's like if you're telling me is a bag of chips nutritious, I'm telling you it's not. But do I think putting a warning label on chips creates maybe a slightly different problem? Is this a net positive? Are we about net positives? Like, are we cool with like utilitarian mentality of net positive? Like, even if there's a cost to it? Like, so I just feel that way of like, all right, we have regulation on certain ultra processed foods, and do we create a negative connotation with these foods? Should there be a negative connotation? Is that a net positive? You know, I just feel like that's, I bet you it's a net positive, but I do think it, people eat less ultra processed foods. That's a good thing. But I think that there's, yeah, better and worse ways maybe to go about communicating that, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, I personally think that a lot of these foods are designed to be overeaten. They're designed to taste really good. They're designed to reach into our, more primal inclinations for highly, you know, high fatty, high sugary foods, because we didn't know when we were going to have our next meal for a while. So I think that these foods are more intentionally designed to be overconsumed. I don't think that there is a beneficent reason that these foods exist so much as to be pleasurable for us. And I'm not saying that pleasure is wrong and that we can't have pleasure, but it's very clearly the case that in many different ways that these foods are meant to be overeaten. They're meant to be very readily available. They're meant to have a long shelf life to be there. So, you know, I think in terms of the net positive, that maybe curbing our consumption and readily availability of these foods might help. This isn't to say that these foods are inherently evil or morally bankrupt or bad. It's to say that they're not really helpful for many different people on their journey, especially towards better health. I think that's kind of a better way of framing it. Instead of saying like, you know, these foods are terrible, they're shit foods or this or that, I would rather say that, you know, they're not the best for what we're trying to do in many different cases.
Yeah, I think everyone sitting in one of our positions wants people to get healthier. Is going to agree with 100% wholeheartedly, we should eat less ultra processed foods. We should eat more minimally processed foods, more whole foods, more fiber, more plants. That one might be contestable by a small minority, but how do we, The question is, how do we get people to do that? And I think what we're talking about is taking a step back and almost making the choice aspect of this easier by going one level above you picking something off a shelf and saying, can we change something from a regulation standpoint so that you are more, you know, as a population, we are more likely to, on average, make more nutritious decisions. How can we make, again, it goes back to this, the philosophical discussion of choice. It's almost like there are people out there talking to the individual about how they should be choosing foods, when what might be more prudent / beneficial is to actually make those decisions easier in some way from a top-down perspective. And I think that it is quite complex and not an easy question to answer.
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, like, I worked a lot with behavioral interventions. So I did a lot of applied behavioral analysis work, which, if you look into that, it's very really cool field, evidence-based, of course. And the thing that really leashed into my mind with that is that behaviors are largely driven by external forces in the environment. So if we set up the environment such a way for people to make better choices, they typically will. I've seen this firsthand working with, like I said, people with severe mental illness and severe mental afflictions, that if you set up a system where positive behaviors are more beneficial, are easier to make, the probability of people making those choices and making those decisions increases substantially. So I think that it's very important for us to think in terms of that. You know, we want to increase people, the adoption of a more health promoting diet. It's really, really about gearing the environment towards that. And I think that if we move the average, just a little bit, I think that's going to help a lot of different people.
Yeah, I love that. We're going to wrap things up here, but I think there's just so much more to say on this topic, but it leaves the door open for us to chat again. Jay, let people know where they can find you. And I'll link our previous podcast, because I actually think we've had now three wonderful discussions, and people don't know who you are. If people don't know who you are, they should go back and listen to those episodes. It's super thoughtful.
Thank you. People can find me on Instagram, Threads, at Thoughts by Jay. So that's at Thoughts by J-E-J. Cool. And I think that's where people could really connect with me and really see my work. So.
Awesome, man. I appreciate your time. I'm going to tag you when everything comes out. So hopefully we can get people. I think you have you should have way more followers than you do. Just one of those people in the space that I look at and I'm like, you're just not doing the social media thing really well. What I mean by that is, like, you're too good. Your heart's like too good and too much in the right place. You're too smart. Heart's too much in the right place. Those are just not things that social media values enough. So hopefully we can shovel some people over your way.
Thanks, man. I really do appreciate that.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.